He kōna i purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Nau mai, whakaronga mai ki te Aotei Whenua. Welcome to Country Life. I'm Sally Round.
And I'm Duncan Smith. G'day. Today we're meeting a rural couple with no close neighbours, which is a good thing really because they run a busy, noisy blacksmith's shop.
Later on, a school is moving onto a block of farmland so the students can get more learning time in the outdoors.
And we have another in our Pacific series, Just Kai. Today we hear how the lack of tourists in Fiji has meant backyard farming is a matter of survival. But first, to our look around the motu. In general, farmers are in a very sweet spot in Northland, although it's still on the dry side on the west coast. More rain at the end of last week and warm daytime temperatures mean pastures are firing along. Autumn calvers are going flat tack, seed is going in, and if they're not calving and seeding, they're on to odd jobs. Our contact says the difference in conditions from the past two autumns is humongous. Around Pukekohe, with a little rain, low evaporation and mild temperatures, crops continue without a growth check. Little or no irrigation has been required this week. As activity is low this time of year, the Growers Association has been busy holding meetings to get members up to speed with the new environmental plans for managing cultivated soils.
Moisture levels are varied across Waikato. It's still very dry in the Morrinsville area. The whole region is 50 millimetres down on the month for rainfall and well below the year to date. 250 millimetres so far compared to the normal 320. With nitrogen and 16 degree soil temperatures, grass is still growing though, but the region needs good rain every week to 10 days. Mobs are being dried off and farmers are getting their heads around Fonterra's new incentive-based payment program. Our contact says there's some confusion out there about how it all works. A farmer in Bay of Plenty was dealing with a wasp's nest when we called. He says with a good dollop of rain this week, farmers will have to watch out for other pests too. They need to make sure they're up with their drenching to control higher worm burdens in stock. Most people got at least 40 millimetres of rain this week and grass is exploding. Still, water tables will take a while to come up after the dry. Thankfully, the flies have disappeared with the cooler nights now, and with decent rain, most people should be able to milk right through. Some of the green variety of kiwi fruit is ripening earlier than normal. Growers are still advertising for staff.
Taranaki has had some nice sunshine and a bit of moisture thrown in. Our contact says there's almost too much grass to keep on top of. Farmers are at the tail end of autumn calving and that's gone well. Our contact's organising the first farm tour to Australia for a long while, now the bubble's opened. These vast broadacre farms in the outback are a total contrast for many New Zealand farmers. It's been warm and there's still moisture in the ground in Manawatū Rangitike. Our contact there has just returned from a few days off down south after the big job of getting the rams out. He's feeling pretty lucky his region's so lush after seeing the bony dry of Banks Peninsula.
Our contact in Tairawhiti East Coast says if more rain doesn't come soon, some big decisions will have to be made. 30 millimetres this week is not enough to make an impact. Farmers are making sure they're down to the bare essential in stock numbers quicker than normal for autumn, as well as rotating stock a bit more quickly. They're looking at fertiliser options. The widely used one, DAP, diammonium phosphate, generally considered a cheaper option for cranking up pastures, is $200 a tonne more than last year. A farmer in southern Hawke's Bay says he's had a minuscule 5 millimetres of rain this week. It's still very dry underfoot, his dams are going down, and other farms around about are under real pressure. The rams are out and a bit of weaning's going on. The stags are also out with the hinds, and young lambs and calves are being drenched. Native tree seeds are being propagated in the greenhouse, ready for planting along his waterways. Fine, warm and settled weather continued this week in Wairarapa. Orange and gold hues in the vineyard make it an attractive time of year, and holidaymakers are piling into the area. A winemaker tells us, with the harvest well down, the vintage has been way less work than normal.
And across the water to Te Waipanamu, where in the Nelson region, the kiwi fruit harvest is well underway. Quite a bit of the gold is now picked and packed, and the green Hayward are having their turn. The fruit is big and the weather's played ball, so orchardists are happy. The fine weather's also been great for the last of the apple harvest. The variety Envy is getting picked at present. Conditions in coastal Marlborough are beyond dire now. Farms that have run out of water are getting rid of stock. Some are selling 30 to 50% of their capital stock. Hoggets are just going off to the works. Devastating for those farmers. They can't send the animals further south because Canterbury cropping farms that often run young stock over winter are also dry. The dry is spreading like mould, and grape growers in the region are saying with volumes 30% down, they're only just breaking even, so Blenheim will suffer as fewer people will be spending. A social outing is being held in Ward next Friday to help farmers and growers. It's being supported by all the key farming organisations and government. And the MPI Drought Committee is also planning to get excess apples from Nelson over the hill to Marlborough to feed stock. Apples are a good energy food.
The west coast is damp. Conditions have been frustrating farmers. Two wet days and one fine. There are hold-ups getting cull cows to the works. Generally, dairy farmers are winding down. Most will be on once-a-day milking, and the weather will dictate how long they milk into May. Even with a good payout, they'll be mindful of stock condition for next spring. And our contacts reminding people sending young stock to runoff blocks to get trace element tests done. She found a copper deficiency really knocked her once good quality calves back. There's a bit of a game of two halves going on in Canterbury, those with irrigation and those without. Irrigated farmers are enjoying the warm temperatures and beautiful autumn days, while dryland farmers just want the weather to change. As we get closer to May, the likely benefit of rain is reducing. Even dead, dry barley grass seed heads are being eaten by sheep in Banks Peninsula.
Central Otago is bleak. There's been a little bit of rain, but it's come too late. It'll be a long winter, with some farmers feeding out already. And they're feeding grain to flush ewes ready for the ram. That's most unusual. Grass is normally enough. It's been a feast and famine season. There was great rain late December until mid-January, so lucerne took off. Farms greened up, and since then, nothing. The region looks grey. The weather's been good in Southland, although strong winds are drying things off, so some parts need rain. Feed levels have really tightened up in the past 2 weeks. Farmers are starting to think about putting stock onto winter crops. The rams are out and ewes are still in good nick. It's hard getting space in the meatworks for lambs.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
We're heading to the Pacific now in the second of our Just Kai series, talking to farmers and producers in the region. Sashi Karan works with farmers around Fiji through a charity known as Friend, helping them grow and market organic produce. Sashi's team has been in high gear during the pandemic because so many people who lost their tourism jobs have moved back onto the land to sustain themselves. I gave her a call and asked her firstly about Friend's line of traditional organic products.
On the shelves you'll see traditionally cooked homemade chutneys, herbal teas, gluten-free flour, coconut flour, desiccated coconut. So these are the things that people have in their backyards, and we try and evolve that into products so that they have a value addition. And a lot of these products are healthy. They have no preservatives and so on. So we're basically trying to bring traditional recipes back onto the shelves. While we do that, we work on health and famine because NCD is quite rife, malnutrition is rife. And more recently, since the pandemic hit Fiji, yes, we've had zero community transmission, but 40% of our GDP was dependent on tourism. And when tourism went, something like 150,000 people have lost their jobs. And if you multiply those 100,000 plus with dependents, it's about half of Fiji's population is heavily impacted with no tourism. So we've been working heavily with them in terms of food bank, nutrition diversity and food security. Because tourism has been there long enough and most intergenerations for 20, 30 years have not had to really dirty their hands and have been very focused on tourism. So to get into replanting needed a different mindset. And while most people went into root crops, which was easier, we had to keep focusing on diverse range of nutritious vegetables to make sure that the family is eating enough. We've also had TC Anna and continuous rainfall this year. So mostly the pandemic impacted Nandi has had continuous floods and damages to the crops as well. So these challenges are there, but most parts of Fiji went into a high gear and high drive of planting. People who have access to land have moved back onto farm.
Are many people grasping the opportunity to do farming, or is it a case of necessity?
Most people, it was almost a natural thing for them to turn to. It brought families together. They found places to garden, easily, readily accessible seeds, borrowing of seedlings. So it was a natural thing for people to move into. And because now there's abundance of tapioca and cassava, we've been evolving a whole range of value addition from there and working with people on how they could make roti or wraps and make flour out of it, make instant noodles out of it, make biscuits out of it. So we are trying to assist people increase the range of products that they could evolve from manioc. And it's gluten-free, which is amazing. Because normally it will be just boiled or put in the lovo or traded or sold.
Sashi, are some of these people who've lost their jobs and are now growing their own food, are they also doing this commercially?
Yes, there's quite a lot of commercial interest. And we've been very lucky that there's enough interest out of for exports. We've also had interest from New Zealand itself on sourcing organic vegetables and spices and herbs from Fiji. So that's given an additional impetus and encouragement for people to actually work on commercially to be able to sell it.
Now, I've also seen that you offer different types of vegetables for people to grow, which are not necessarily traditional. Oyster mushrooms, for instance.
Mushrooms are so quick and easy to grow, and it requires such little space. So for Nandi in particular, which is urban and peri-urban, and people have very little spaces, the uptake has been good. And people are very excited because, you know, it could take up to 2 weeks for them to see the mushrooms. And, you know, we traditionally have not been eating mushrooms. So there's a lot of interest now in cooking mushrooms and value-adding and being able to sell it.
So in general, people coping, do you think, there, especially in the west of Fiji, which has been so badly affected by the lack of tourists?
People have been coping, though in an extreme struggle. What we've seen is much more innovation. People who are skilled have turned to innovation, created a lot of little enterprises where they're able to support the families. But it has been a very difficult journey, especially with continuous rain this year that kept damaging the crops. There is family ties, there's resilience, but it is really at the brink. You know, people are running out of the savings for the past year, whether it's superannuation or personal savings. So it's not easy.
And that was Sashi Kiran talking to me from Lautoka in Fiji.
Next on Country Life, Carol's taking us to a rural property half an hour's drive from Te Awamutu in Waikato.
So again, nice and steady with that sledgehammer. It's not about the power, it's about the accuracy. Just, yep, nice and
flat.
Nice and flat, and bring that up to the same height so you get a nice rhythm.
How long are you leaving that in there for, Rob?
Oh, only until it gets hot, which is not long.
Yeah, that's only been in there less than a minute, probably.
Yes.
Again, now it's hot. Red hot.
Very hot fire. Well, sorry, almost it's orange at the moment. That's the one. Now head on the high spot as we go down.
Rob Pinkney is a blacksmith.
So it's all about the rhythm.
He's on a mission to save his traditional and dying trade.
Listen to that. You can dance to it. So you notice how I'm using my tool to keep timing with you.
Yep.
So you're, and I can move the stock between your hits.
Yep. You'll lead the rhythm, and I just continue.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'll keep the beat, and
yeah,
you lead the rhythm.
Exactly.
Today, he's holding a hands-on class for half a dozen or so people who are keen to learn more.
They say, there's a saying that there's no better silent communication between a good horse and a good rider. But I reckon there's also, the same applies to a good blacksmith and a good striker. You can work all day and not say a word, especially if you don't like him.
I won't read too much.
Okay, that's beautiful. The whole concept of what they're coming here for is to see what a proper working, traditional working blacksmith shop looks like and feels like.
Are there many in New Zealand?
No, we're probably the only one that does traditional blacksmithing like this. And when I say traditional blacksmithing, we obviously make a lot of knives, but we also do a lot of traditional fire-welded axes, fire-welded tools, which are all very, you know, old techniques done in coal fires. So we're probably sort of the last stand of original blacksmithing here.
And who are you expecting today?
Oh, I'm not quite sure who's coming today. It's we'll have a full class, full day from 9 o'clock. If we get them kitted up with some aprons and some eyewear and safety wear, and then we're into it. We light up, get them on the coal fire on a sledgehammer, and they get into it. We've got Vojta from the Czech who works for us now, and the two of us will guide them through it through the morning.
Hey guys,
good day.
Hi. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, I'm Rock.
Yeah,
nice to meet you.
This is my son Jake.
Hey Jake.
This is called spring steel, and this is our kind of stock. We call them stock.
And it's going to turn into a knife by the end of the day.
It's going to turn into beautiful knives, that's right.
Now, what brought you here?
Me and my wife, we were working back in Czech, and we were very unhappy with our jobs. So we decided we want to have adventure before we start a family. So we came in here, and yeah, one thing led to another, and here I am.
What were you doing at home?
I was working in a big worldwide company as a logistics manager. Yeah, and that was not it. I was working in the office my whole life. I never knew what I was supposed to be doing. You know, I was kind of looking for everything, looking for my true call. Yeah, and 4 months into New Zealand, blacksmithing just popped into my head like that. So I was, yeah, why not? Why not to try? So I tried to look around, and I found Rob, and I was bothering him long enough, and he said, okay, come on, we can make something out. First, it was just, come on, we have a pretty busy week, so you can help us out. And 9 months later, I'm still here.
Wow.
Living the dream. I really say living the dream because it is awesome.
You knew nothing about blacksmithing.
I wouldn't say nothing. I had this one-day course back in Czech as well, but it didn't went as planned because the only thing I had was 3 enormous blisters on my hand. And in the end, I left the knife too long in the forge and it burned in half. And I thought, okay, blacksmithing is not for me, but I think it is.
What do you like about it?
What do I like about it? I mean, what's there not to like? I mean, you make beautiful creation out of very basic piece of steel. And that's incredible. And after working my whole life in the office, 8-9 hours behind the computer and literally not be able to see, you know, physical outcome of your work. And after same amount of time, 9 hours, 8 hours in forge, you can make knife, beautiful knives, and you can really see and feel and do something with the product that you made. It's, for me, it's incredible. I was thinking about you really transforming reality. That's incredible. That's incredible.
You're waiting for a few more?
Yes, I'm just checking on them.
Are they coming?
They're all booked and they've paid, so yeah.
So we do about 3 or 4 days a week.
Really, with people coming to learn the trade?
Yes.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. One day we decided we'd like to spend more time in the forge and that we wanted sort of to save the craft of blacksmithing. And, so we just decided to open it up for the public, and then we started with a class every now and then, and then we soon realised that there's an actual real interest for it. So it's our main business now.
What were you doing before?
So before we were running a farrier company, so that was mostly Rob running that. That's where I could only help out with the admin side of things. Yeah, and then we've slowly just transitioned into this. Yeah.
Where do people come from? Well, here are some people pulling up now.
So, most people come from the big cities around, so from Auckland, Hamilton, Tauranga. But we've got people coming from all over New Zealand, really. People making special trips from the South Island. Morning, guys.
Hi there.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Did you find us a ride?
Yes.
Did we?
She navigated and I drove. And
he's like,
yeah.
Really? You go here?
Cool.
I'm like, oh, yes.
Yeah. You sure about that? Up that hill? Yeah. Hey, I'm Aria.
Ian.
Nice to meet you.
Hi, Heather.
Nice to meet you.
How did you become a blacksmith?
I did an apprenticeship as a farrier and general blacksmith back about 30-odd years ago.
in Matamata for a guy called Malcolm Telfer. We made everything, all our horseshoes, all our tools to make the horseshoes, and we also did, you know, some general blacksmithing as well, mainly, you know, re-tipping crowbars and things like that for the council.
And now what would they do? Go and just buy a new one with
them? Yeah, I don't know. It's a bit like Bunnings, I suppose. You break a handle and an axe and you go and buy a new one. For an extra $5, you can buy the whole thing. And when you see what's involved in making an axe traditionally, these axes that we make, you hand down through generations.
You've done a lot of work with horses, though, as well, haven't you?
Yes, well, farrying has been a very strong part of my life because it's been the bread and butter for my blacksmithing.
So you must have seen forge after forge close, have you?
Yes. And, you know, since the railway workshops closed, which we had some very skilled men here back in the day, that was probably before my time, really. There was a forge just about in every village. I mean, you know, every town, like where I grew up, and Kaitaia had a forge and Kaikoi had a forge. And these were general smiths, you know. These guys could shoe horses. They could also, they fixed everything. Man, they did anchors, they did chain, they did everything. And even in my lifetime, I've seen all those forges close down. So, it died out fast. Yeah. So what we do is we're saving all these old traditional techniques on how to, you know, the fire welded axe or the folded axe, the adzes, all the tools that these techniques are pretty well lost, and we're working hard to keep these tools still being made.
Yeah. Got any thoughts on what you want to make today?
Oh, the hair clip's cool.
It is.
Oh, I might make that.
You might make that?
You've
your
got
hair?
The hair for
yeah,
it.
So your hair
hey,
be,
yeah. That's a herb cutter, and you can use it as a pizza cutter as well. Yeah.
I might make that.
Yes.
Yeah, that's really cool. So, like, fresh herbs or like,
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I
like to cook a lot, so I think that'd be
yeah. Cool. All right, cool.
So we're just raking up a bit of coal into the fire. And what we do, we've got some nice Westport coal here from the Stockton mine. This is some of the best coking coal in the world, actually. Because we're doing such technical fire welds, we need a very hot, clean heat. And this is the stuff that gets us there. One shovel full of this fuel will give us enough energy that'll outdo just about anything else I know. It's very good fuel, very efficient. And we're very, very lucky to have it here in New Zealand. So you can see that fire just naturally drawing. So there's no fumes off that fire at all in this workshop. So again, bring coal up onto the fire, which cokes up. And then when it's in its coking form, that's when we use it. So again, it's no different to burning wood into charcoal. Once you've got the charcoal, yeah, you can cook on it. And that's what we forge in, and that's why we can get, with the oxygen in that, we can get these incredibly good heats in it.
It's very shiny.
Yes, yeah, well, actually, funny enough, we nickname it shiny coal. That's one way we can tell the quality of it. Yeah, so it's very black, very shiny, and we know that it's good stuff.
What's Rob like at his job? I would say incredible, to be honest. Just the first look into the workshop, I first came here, it was so magical, because to build a workshop like this, you have to be blacksmith, not as an occupation, but inside, in your heart. When Rob's work, when he's at the anvil and at the forge and having, you know, swinging his hammer, you can see that's there. That's really magic happening. I also always tell him that he makes it look so easy, but when you try it, it's very hard to do.
So what I'm going to do is send you over there with Voiter, and you're going to start forming this into a nice handle. So go and look at one of the samples of, and you just want a nice handle grip going on here, and you'll forge this out and down. So I'm just measuring up this little piece of steel to make this tomahawk. So basically these are what we call folded axes. This technique dates right back to the Vikings. It's one of the earliest ways of making an axe. Very cool way of making an axe. Big fire weld in it. and it's formed up basically in a mirror image and then folded over and firewalded together. So pretty cool. So again, very, very important technique for early pioneer blacksmiths, because they could come out to places like New Zealand or Australia or wherever, and they could make axes out of strap iron, which was a lot easier to get than a block of iron, you know. And as long as you could fire weld well, you're in the money. You could make axes wherever you were.
And then you could clear the land and feed your family.
Yeah, and you could sell them. I mean, axes in these days were worth a lot of money. They were a very important trade item. There's been a lot of land bought with axes. Yeah.
How's that knife looking?
Oh, the knife's looking amazing. It's strange. You go from this block of steel and you just shape it into this knife-looking thing. It's an experience.
And you're going to use it, you said, to prepare the meat for your barbecue?
Yeah, we've got an offset smoker at home, so when we have large pieces of meat, there's usually a fat cap on top, so it's just to get in there and help get that fat cap off.
And so now, that just needs sharpening, does it?
Yeah, pretty well. We love doing these. Classic butcher knife with a beautiful sweep back bend in them. Very handy, very traditional, very New Zealand classic. If anyone's grown up on the countryside, been around, especially dry stock farmers, they always had one of these on their hips. They're just a good home killing knife, butchering knife. And yeah, if you've ever been to a marae, to the wharekai, all the men out the back, they've all got these butcher knives. Yeah, they're really cool. They're a very handy knife. I've used one all my life as well.
How's it going?
Yes, awesome. Yeah. Absolutely amazing. Loving it, eh?
Is it starting to look like a knife?
Yeah, definitely is. Yeah, the handle's starting to take shape, and yeah, that's awesome. I had a whole lot of respect for them, but now I've got a whole lot more as well. It's amazing what they do. My son's said he's got a mean sweat up, and yeah, I'm the same as well. I think my son's going to have sore arms tomorrow as well. I'll probably have sore arms as well, I think. Yeah.
What's your hope here? Do you want somebody younger than you to come through and think,
exactly,
this is what I'd love to do?
Yeah, some guys like Voita, yeah. I want to teach these techniques or let people open their eyes to it before it's lost. You know, in a very short time since, you know, say the grandfather of my trade, John Carter, who came over, you know, who's the English smith that had started my family of smiths off. In between only a couple of generations, we've lost most of the knowledge, you know, a lot of the knowledge he would have had. You know, when men did their apprenticeships as blacksmiths back in the day in those big forges in London and places like that, you know, they had amazing amounts of resourcefulness and experience and techniques that they had up their sleeve. You know, that basically their family had to pay a bond, and if they went anywhere in the world and couldn't do a job that they were asked to, the firm gave the money back to the family. And that's how serious it was and how knowledgeable these guys were. But in a very short time, you know, no one uses coal fires anymore. We're losing it very fast. That's why the folded axe, that's one of those techniques that is imperative to save while we can. So, yeah, it's basically, that's what I want people to learn it, go home and practice it, throw their life at it. Mm. But it's bigger than us. That's the thing. The craft is bigger. It's about culture. It's about history. You know, this is just a small part of what we need to save as New Zealanders. Yeah, I wouldn't want to let it slip through my fingers on my shift. That's for sure.
Rob Pinkney from Kowhai Forge. You also heard from his wife Aria and from Voita Kuchera. Rob worked as a farrier for 14 years in Japan and was the first foreign farrier to have his own company there. We've popped some pictures from the day on our webpage.
Hi, I'm Robin Howe of Remarkable Valets, the cutest sheep in the world, and you're listening to Country Life RNZ National.
Steiner school students in Motueka will have a nature-based learning environment once their new farm campus is complete. Cosmo Kentish Barnes is on site with outdoor educator Lindsay Ellison and Peter Garlick, who's been working on the construction project since its inception.
My job has been to help the school develop and to move from its current premises to buying land and to build a new school on a farm with a whole new emphasis on being more outdoors and farm orientated.
Mm. How much land have you got here?
13.6 hectares, just on the edge of Motueka.
And we can see a digger up there on the hill doing some work. It's not quite finished yet, is it?
No, there's still a lot happening, but the official opening's 1st of May, so it's not far away.
What is the background behind this huge project, and how long has it taken to get to this point?
Well, I guess our school started in 1984 as a kindergarten, and then in 2002 they added a primary school. And it was back about 10 years ago that the community got together. We were in a rented building where we are currently, and realising that the rented building in town wasn't really what the community wanted. Mm. They wanted space, they wanted a farm, lots of nature. And so the community just at a meeting decided that's what they wanted. And we set a vision. And we all were it was a very, very exciting meeting because everyone was just allowed to sit around and imagine this fantastic school. And we drew pictures and wrote little documents. And then came the reality is, well, how on earth do you do that? You know, where do you get millions of dollars and a big piece of land and build a school? And, you know, we were a private school, small community. You know, there certainly wasn't a lot of money. But over the years, we've just kept focused on that goal. And eventually we raised enough money to buy this farm. And we were very lucky. We purchased the land at a time before land prices got too crazy. So we got the farm for a good price. And then the next key to development was becoming a state integrated school. So as of last year, we were accepted to be state integrated. And then that's allowed us to, we've been fundraising, of course, and that allowed us to then borrow some money. The banks got more interested in us, and that got us enough money to build the new school.
So how much is it costing all up?
At the end of the stage one, we'll be about $3 million in. And just about half of that has been raised from our own community through donations and fundraising. And then there's another about $500,000 of loans that have come from supporters, and then about $1 million from the bank.
That shows how passionate a lot of people are about this school farm.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, there's a lot of supporters and parents and ex-parents that have really worked very hard for many years to make this happen.
Now, tell me about the land. We are standing on the flat part down by the creek, but I guess a lot of the land goes beyond the hill where the digger is.
Yeah, so most of the farm is what you say rolling hill country. Just this about 1 hectare down here of flat ground, which obviously is where the sports field had to go and the car park. Mm. But the school is mainly up on the first rise. And then behind that, there's sort of a gully, about a 1 hectare gully, which has been now fully fenced. And we're halfway through replanting it, a big riparian planting project. And that planting's been going on for 5 years now.
And I guess this used to be a sheep and beef farm.
Sheep and apples. So this half of the farm has always just been grazing. And the other half of the farm was mostly in apples.
Are there any apple trees still left?
Not many, but there's just over a hectare of pears. And so we have been running a pear orchard, but that's coming to an end now. We got hit by the big hailstorms on Boxing Day, so the fruit was all damaged. So we're going to give up on that.
How tragic that you lost all the fruit.
Yeah, well, it's the second time it's happened in 5 years. So, it's a bit of a hard one being an orchardist.
Mm, well, I guess it's also important for the students to know that nature does throw these curveballs at us every now and then.
Exactly, yeah. And it's great that the students will get to spend lots of time outdoors. And, you know, and realise sometimes things are tough and there are disappointments and setbacks. And what they need to see is that the parents just sort of stand strong and they move forward and deal with whatever comes at you. It's a good lesson.
In front of us is a building that's finished and there are kids in there already.
Yeah, so that's our first classroom that we finished last year. So yeah, that's been in use for term one. So that's probably our new entrance. Children are in there, hence the bigger fence. And then 5 more classrooms up on top of the hill.
Lindsay, you are also part of the Steiner School Farm. What's your role here?
I came here and set up a farm-to-table program. So my passion is to connect the children with food and where the food is from and anything nature-based. So what we did here was we built an outdoor kitchen. I was lucky enough to get given some funding for the program. And I got some very passionate parents together one weekend and they put together an outdoor kitchen for me. So since then, the children have been biking out here from school every week. They come to the kitchen, we go and harvest up in the garden and the orchard. And then a group of 9 of them come here and they make a meal for all their friends for 30, 30-odd people, and they're incredible cooks. They make a three-course meal. I don't have to do anything. I just tell them what they're making, and they're all completely competent in this space. So it's been really amazing to watch that happen and watch them as well. Now they play around with flavours themselves. They see what's in the garden, and they make suggestions. So that's really nice to see that happening with them naturally.
So there's a really nice area there for them to prepare the food. There's a sink. There are tables. Everything a budding chef needs.
Yeah, and actually it was inspired by the children, because this lean-to was here when I came to the school, and we used to come out here with a class to do various things on the farm. We built the pizza oven, and we used to just set up in this space and just cook really basically. And then one day one of the kids was like, we need a kitchen here. We should start really just cooking here all the time. And from that seed, yeah, this kitchen was born. And they really like the outdoors. There's definitely would be a benefit to put a wall in, because sometimes we're fighting with the wind. Yep. But I think that they really enjoy the feeling of being completely outside. Mm. And, yeah.
So the food that they prepare and cook here comes off the land?
A lot of it does, yeah. Obviously, I've got to go and buy rice, or if we need flour. But generally, I come up in the garden at the weekend and see what we've got. And I get a harvest list for them, and they're literally picking it and eating it 2 hours later. And the good thing is they eat everything. Mm. If they grow it, they'll eat it. It's really that simple.
And you are also heavily involved with the development of the land, aren't you?
Yeah, my drive is how to integrate the children and the curriculum with what's happening on the wider farm. So that's definitely something that we're always looking into. And once we've got a working farm, I'll be working with whoever is running that and making sure that through every stage of the curriculum the children are involved. So class one will have a particular job, and they work their way up, and they look up to the senior students that have got their jobs, and that'll be woven into the Steiner curriculum.
Yes. Why do you think it's so important for the students to learn these outdoor skills?
Well, you know, fundamentally it's life skills, which they have to have, but the work that goes on under the surface of that is really, really powerful. Once you get children working with their hands, they just open up their minds. So it's a really good space to have bigger conversations. Obviously, the environmental side of that is huge, to teach them where their food comes from and the health benefits if they just pick something and eat it, versus it going off to a cold storage and then driving to a shop and then it sits in the fridge. So that's really important. And for me, this is the part of environmental awareness that I feel really passionate about, because if we look after the soil, then, you know, everything else falls into place. And this is a way that I can do it without being an environmental activist saying we need to fix climate change. Actually, if we just teach the kids to grow food, it's a massive tick.
Well, let's head up the hill to see the new classrooms and the land you've set aside for farming. We have come halfway up the hill, and we are overlooking the classrooms here on the farm. And Peter, can you explain a bit about the construction of these buildings?
Yeah, well, our challenge was to be as eco-friendly as we could within a very tight budget. And many of the features that we would like were sort of on the more expensive end. But one thing we did do is we made each classroom a standalone building. And the reason for that was that we could get natural light in from three directions. So they're really placed so that they'll get first sun, first thing in the morning, you know, all day sun into every classroom. And that therefore will improve, you know, the heating and the light in the buildings. We put them onto insulated concrete pads to try and also regulate the temperature. But we also were putting in fireplaces in the classrooms. So each classroom will have a fire.
Oh, how nice.
Yeah.
Cozy.
Lovely. And the current school does, and the teachers and the students really like the fact that in the morning they come, they light the fire. Well, of course, now we're on a farm, we've got access to a lot more of our own wood. So essentially it's carbon neutral heating by just coppicing trees on the farm and providing our own firewood.
And the view from the classrooms is quite spectacular. We can see all the kiwi fruit and apple orchards across the plains.
Yeah, and then in the far distance, that's Kahurangi National Park and Mount Arthur in the distance.
We're just about at the top of the hill, and this is where you've got a rather gorgeous garden, Lindsay.
Yeah.
What are you growing here?
At the moment, lots of calendula, sunflowers, herbs. We've got courgette. We've just harvested all the corn in the last session. The children, when they come up here, the first thing that they do is they go and harvest something to eat, and then I can talk to them about what we're going to be doing. I've just recently started bringing up the students from class one, because now they're here on site, and it's really nice to just wander through here and graze and talk about what's happening in the garden. We've got lots of delicious peaches at the moment, and pears and apples. Yeah, it's a real treat to come in here with them.
The students must make a beeline for the orchard.
They do, but they're really respectful, and they know what, you know, they always ask if they're allowed to harvest, and they know how to harvest.
So have the students planted all the plants that are growing here?
Yep, all the students have planted. I've just actually seen, I asked them to put in this new pathway in the last class, and they've done that, so that's really nice to see. And about 4 years ago, actually, my son's class came up here and they dug this first little herb garden in the middle. We came up here and there was just grass, and we had scythes, and they were the pioneers, and that was really nice. And same herbs are still growing, so that's great. Those herbs actually bring lots of bumblebees in summer, which is quite nice because you don't always see lots of bumblebees anymore. And we recently put up this beautiful shade, so we get to sit down under there. We've got benches that the children made.
So they get to do a bit of carpentry as well.
Yes, they do. And over here, they've just actually been helping to build. We've got a shade house, we've got a tool shed happening, and we're about to put up a tunnel house. So they've been involved in that project as well.
And we can see the farmland on the other side of the vegetable garden.
We were grazing sheep there, and unfortunately the person who had the sheep moved the flock away. So just as the spring growth happened, we lost our flock of sheep. So we're down to 5 at the moment. We probably need about 30. Yeah. But anyway, we're just negotiating with someone else to bring some stock in. So at the moment we've got a lot of long grass. In places we've just mowed the grass and let it, just dropped it where it is, so it's, which is good for the soil, keeps a cover on the soil and gets some of that grass and carbon back in.
It's like a blank canvas for you, Lindsay.
It's really exciting. Yeah, I'd like to take you down. We're just in the throes of starting up an outdoor classroom, and we're going to be working in there on Monday for the first time, and it'd be cool to walk down there and show you.
Let's have a look.
So this is a gully that's going back all into native. So as you can see at the moment, the trees are all about just under a metre high. Some of them are getting up to now 2 or 3 metres. Mm. But you can quite easily see that in 10, 20 years' time, there'll be quite a forest here right at the back of the school. So the students will have a forested area to play in. But anyway, we're at the planting stage at the moment.
And the senior students that come out every week, they've been spending an hour in here, and they're just releasing the natives and learning how to look after them properly and mulch them and water them. So that's really nice for them to be part of that process. All the work that they have to do here isn't always glamorous, but it's good to teach them that sometimes you've just got to roll up your sleeves and get stuck in.
Do you ever struggle to get the students to do some of those harder tasks?
I think sometimes by the time you get to class 7 and you're working with 12 and 13 year olds, sometimes you get a few reluctant ones on the edges, but actually that's when they really need to, at that age is when they really need to dig in and do some work. So with a little bit of encouragement, they get stuck in, and then they always really enthusiastically speak about what they've been doing.
And a lot of the times when they're out here doing things, there's a lot of maths and English and other things going on at the same time. And it's quite amazing how the teachers have woven their classroom material into the activities that they do outside. And so sometimes it's reinforcing it, just coming at numbers from a different angle, whether it be counting out seeds and all those sorts of things.
Linking all those different topics together.
Yeah, exactly. And often, academic-y type subjects which you translate into something you're doing with your hands, with your hands in the dirt, but you can still be doing numbers and learning the names of things and how to spell things.
So this track is going to take us up to where we're going to be doing some outdoor classroom work with the students. So that'll be a place where work like whittling, weaving, carving, clay work, sitting around the fire, learning about fire skills, that's all going to happen up in this space. So it's really exciting.
We're under the shelter belt now, it's nice and cool here.
So it's a little bit like they're going to be walking into this magic space.
And you've got, what, 12 logs ready for the students to sit on in a circle, and there'll be a nice fire in the middle.
That's right, yeah, perfect. What else do you need?
This area here is at the bottom of one of your larger paddocks. What is going to happen to this land?
Yeah, so at the moment we're working on a proposal to put in quite a big market garden. We're quite lucky. We've got a lake and a dam on the farm, so we'll be able to get a market garden growing here. We've got plenty of water. And then the idea is that will be then sold through a box scheme. I mean, we've got 100 students. So it means we've got at least 50 families. So you've got a ready-made market for that. And hopefully then we can just expand that beyond our own community within a couple of years.
Do you have your own tractor and other farm machinery?
No, we don't. And that's, again, all part of this next stage is setting up the farm. And lots of things depend on what funding we can access and who we get in to be our key farmer, if they come with equipment or not.
Yes. So would you like to have a farmer that actually gets involved in the everyday learning,
yeah,
as well as helping out with ploughing or cutting the grass?
Exactly, yeah. So, I mean, the whole farm is owned by a charitable trust. That charitable trust's primary activity is education. And so the farm is sort of a pedagogical farm. You know, we want to produce food, lovely, you know, nutrient-dense organic food, but we definitely want the students to be able to come and be involved as well. So it's going to be an interesting commercial enterprise that's going to be, it obviously has to pay its way and produce food, but we want to be able to involve the students. So in some ways the students will have their own garden, which Lindsay was just showing you, but they'll also be able to come over here and see something at a much larger scale, you know, with cows and machinery.
So will the students be involved in milking and feeding the animals?
Well, yep, you're talking into the vision realm at the moment, but that's the way we're heading.
Yes, definitely. Definitely it will be woven into the curriculum, which will be appropriate for their age and stage. So, yeah, they'll be tending chickens and milking cows and making cheese and just anything that goes hand in hand with working on a biodynamic farm.
So in terms of the curriculum, how long each week would they spend outside learning on the land?
At the moment, the students that come out to the farm spend a whole day here, and the younger classes, they do a farm-to-table program, which is about an hour and a half a week. But outside of that, the class teachers are doing lots of work outside, and they'll be able to do much more when they come here full-time.
And I think we're also quite lucky, you know, we're here in the Nelson, Tasman area. You know, we get a lot of lovely sunny weather, and our winters are not very cold, they're quite mild. So, you know, we'll be outside all year round.
Yes. Now, just backtracking a bit, can you just give me a brief overview of the whole Rudolf Steiner philosophy in terms of, you know, education?
There's an enormous amount of thinking and philosophy behind the Rudolf Steiner approach. And, of course, it's education, but it's also farming and other areas as well. So there's definitely some strong themes, one of them being that care for people and care for the land. And so, you know, in some ways, Rudolf Steiner and biodynamics was the start of the modern organic farming movement. And I think the other theme that comes through in the education is it's quite a gentle approach to education, and it's very hands-on. It's focuses also on developing, you know, head, heart and hands, so we have quite a holistic view.
And you've dedicated a nice big area of the flat for sporting
yep,
activities.
That's right, exactly. You know, lots of physical activity, lots of running around, and our students are involved with the, you know, all the various competitions with the other schools, which is great. It means that, you know, they do get to interact with the students all around this district. And then on the flip side of that is that once this farm is a little bit further on, we're hoping to invite all those students from the other schools to come and do activities here, because we'll have something quite unique which they won't have. You know, most schools now do have a garden to table or, you know, some sort of gardening program. But, you know, we're on 13 hectares and we can have animals. And so I think it'll be quite neat for those students to come and see at a bigger scale and to maybe have a day out here and participate.
Peter Garlick, ending that story from Motueka Steiner School's new farm campus. Cosmo was also talking to the school's farm-to-table coordinator, Lindsay Ellison.
Well, that's it for this week. Now, our webpage has got photos and more stories, and you can always subscribe to our podcast there. And if you want to get in touch, our email is country@rnz.co.nz.
Do join us next week when we're battling wilding pines on a hillside at Molesworth Station. Have a great weekend.
Bye.